This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Guilty as Sin by Tammy Hoag, performed by Jennifer Van Dyke.
Justice has but one form. Evil has many. Moses ben Jacob Meir ibn Ezra. Prologue. Time to die, birthday bitch. Birthday. 36. The birthday Ellen had been dreading. Suddenly 36 seemed far too young. She flung herself up the stairs, stumbling as one heel caught an edge. She grabbed for the handrail, her fingers scraping the rough plaster of the wall, breaking a nail, skinning her knuckles. The stairwell was barely lit, drawing in the ragged edges of illumination that fell from the lights in the halls above and below. Security lights. They offered nothing in the way of security. In the back of her mind, she heard a low, smoky voice.
Your boss needs to have a word with someone about security. This is a highly volatile case. Anything might happen.
She reached the third floor and turned down the hall, heading east. If she could make it down the east stairs, if she could make it to the walkway between the buildings, he wouldn't dare try to take her in the walkway with the sheriff's department mere feet away.
We've got you now, bitch!
There were telephones in the offices she ran past. The offices were locked. Her self-appointed assassin was jogging behind her, laughing. The sound went through her like a spear, like the sure knowledge that he would kill her. Pursuit may not have been his plan, but it had become a part of the game. The game. The insanity of it was as terrifying as the prospect of death. Beat the system, wreck lives, end lives. Nothing personal, just a game. She ran past Judge Grapko's courtroom and ducked around the corner that led back toward the southeast stairwell. Scaffolding filled the stairwell, cutting off her escape route. The scaffolding for the renovators. Christ! She was going to die because of the stupid plaster freeze.
Checkmate, clever bitch.
The northeast stairs looked a mile away. Midway stood the iron gates that blocked the skyway between the courthouse and the jail. She lunged for the fire alarm on the wall, grabbing the glass tube that would break and summon help. The tube snapped. Nothing. No sound. No alarm.
Oh, God. No!
She clawed at the useless panel. The goddamn renovations. New alarms going in. State of the art.
Come along, Ellen. Be a good bitch and let me kill you.
She grabbed the handle of the door to the fire hose and yanked.
You have to die, bitch. We have to win the game.
His hand closed on her arm. Her fingers closed on the handle of the axe. Journal entry. They think they've beaten us at our own game. Poor, simple minds. Every chess master knows in the quest for victory he will concede minor defeats. They may have won the round, but the game is far from over. They think they've beaten us. We smile and say, "Welcome to the next level." Chapter 1. Monday, January 24th, 1994.
"He said it was a game,"
she murmured, her voice whisper soft and tight with pain. She lay in a hospital bed, the deep purple bruises on her face a stark contrast to the bleached white of the sheets and the ash white of her skin. Her right eye was nearly swollen shut, the flesh the color of an overripe plum. Bruises circled her throat like a purple satin band where she had been choked. A fine line of stitches mended a split in her lip. The pain triggered flashes of memory. Sudden, violent, blaring. A memory of pain so sharp, so intense, It took on qualities of sound and taste, the smell of fear, the presence of evil.
Clever girl. You think we're going to kill you? Perhaps.
Her throat being closed by hands she couldn't see, the instinct to survive surging, fear of death riding the crest of the wave.
We could kill you.
The voice a silky murmur.
You wouldn't be the first.
The air caught like a pair of fists in her lungs, then slowly seeped out between her teeth. Assistant County Attorney Ellen North waited for the moment to pass. She sat on a high stool beside the bed, a legal pad and small cassette recorder on the bedside tray to her right. She had met Megan O'Malley only days before. Her impression of the field agent for the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension had consisted of a handful of adjectives. Tough, gutsy, capable, determined, a small woman with fierce green eyes and a big chip on her shoulder. The first woman to break the male ranks of BCA field agents. Her first day on the job in the Deer Lake Regional Office had been day one of the Kirkwood kidnapping. 12 days ago. 12 days that had taken the previously innocent, quiet, rural college town into the depths of a nightmare. In her efforts to crack the case, the chip had been effectively knocked off Megan's shoulder and smashed, and Megan along with it. She had come too close to unraveling the puzzle. Beneath the covers, her damaged right knee was elevated. Her right hand was encased in a cast. According to her doctor, the hand was badly smashed, and he despaired of the poor, darling little bones recovering, even with the meticulous attention of a specialist. Megan's transfer from Deer Lake Community Hospital to the Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis was scheduled for Tuesday, weather permitting. She would have been transported the night of her ordeal, but Minnesota had been clutched in the grip of a January storm. 2 days later, Deer Lake was just beginning to dig out from under 10 inches of new snow.
He said it was a game. Megan started again. Taking Josh, taking me, fooling everyone. We fooled you all along, he said. We, always we.
Did you at any time hear another person in the room?
No.
She tried to swallow, and her face tightened against a new wave of pain.
We've calculated all the moves, all the options, all the possibilities. We can't lose. Do you understand me? You can't defeat us. We're very good at this game, brilliant and invincible.
8-year-old Josh Kirkwood had disappeared from outside the Gordy Knutson Memorial Ice Arena after hockey practice on an otherwise normal Wednesday night. No useful physical evidence left behind. The only witness, a woman casually glancing out her window half a block away and seeing nothing to cause alarm. A little boy being picked up from hockey practice. No sign of fear or force. The only trace of him left behind had been his duffel bag with a note tucked inside. A child has vanished. Ignorance is not innocence, but sin. A game. And she had been used as a pawn. The idea brought Megan a rush of useless emotions, anger, outrage, a hated sense of vulnerability. The only satisfaction was in the fact that they had spoiled his little coup de grace, and now Garrett Wright was sitting in a cell in the Deer Lake City Jail. Garrett Wright, professor of psychology at Harris College, the man the media had pulled in as an expert witness to attempt to explain the twisted workings of the mind that had perpetrated this crime. The Kirkwoods' neighbor, a respected member of the community, a volunteer counselor of juvenile offenders, a man above reproach. But though Wright had been apprehended, there was still no sign or word of Josh.
You were blindfolded?
Yes.
You didn't actually see Garrett Wright?
I saw his feet. He has this habit of rocking back on his heels. I noticed it the first time I met him. He was doing it that night. I could see his boots when he stood close enough.
That's not exactly a fingerprint.
Megan scowled at the assistant county attorney, her temper cutting through the haze of drugs and pain. Goddamn lawyers. Garrett Wright had drugged her, terrorized her, abused her, humiliated her. He may well have ended the career that was everything to her. A decade in law enforcement, a degree in criminology, a certificate from the FBI Academy. She was a damn good cop. Yet Ellen North could sit here, every blonde hair in place, and calmly question her as if she were just another civilian, as blind as Lady Justice herself. It was him, the son of a bitch! He knew where I was going. He knew I was that close to finding him out. He caught me, beat the shit out of me, wrapped me in a sheet of evidence proving he stole Josh.
We don't know yet what the bedsheet will prove, Ellen interjected. We don't know whose blood is on it. The lab has a rush on it, but DNA tests take weeks. The blood could be Josh's or not. We have the blood samples from his parents. If the DNA analysis shows the blood on the sheet could be from a child of Paul Kirkwood and Dr. Hannah Garrison, we've got something we can use. We might just as easily have a red herring. It would make more sense for the kidnapper to try to throw us off his trail.
It makes his kind of sense, Megan argued. He believes he can get away with anything, but he underestimated us. We got him dead to fucking rights. Whose side are you on?
You know what side I'm on, Megan. I want to see Wright punished as much as you.
You can't even come close.
She couldn't argue the point. The bitter hate that laced Megan's tone was indisputable. The emotion Wright had forged and hammered within her with every blow was something deeper than Ellen could even imagine. It was a victim's private rage, compounded by the humiliation of a proud cop. Ellen knew that her own personal, moral hunger for justice was a pale appetite in comparison. I want him convicted, she clarified, but the case against him has to be airtight. I don't want his attorney to see even a hairline crack. The stronger our case, the better our chances of squeezing the truth out of him. It could mean getting Josh back. Or finding out the whereabouts of his body. She left that line unspoken. Everyone involved in the case knew the chances of finding Josh Kirkwood alive. Wright and his accomplice, whoever that accomplice might be, could not afford to let go the one person who could identify them absolutely as the kidnappers. If we can present Wright and his attorney with a strong enough case, if we can threaten them with a murder charge and make them believe we can make it stick, even though we have no body, then Wright might give us Josh. We can force his hand if we're careful and clever enough.
We thought you were a clever girl, but you're just another stupid bitch.
A disembodied voice, never rising above a whisper, but taut and humming with fury. She trembled, blind, powerless, vulnerable, waiting. Then the pain struck from one direction, then another, then another. A cry of pain, of weakness, of fear, started in the heart of her, and Megan struggled to choke it off in her throat.
Are you all right? Ellen asked, with quiet concern.
Should I call for a nurse?
No.
Maybe we should quit for now. I could come back in half an hour.
No.
Ellen said nothing, giving her a chance to change her mind, though she didn't expect that to happen. Megan O'Malley hadn't got where she was in the Bureau by backing off. The BCA was the top law enforcement agency in the upper Midwest, one of the best in the country, and Megan was one of the best, a good cop with the tenacity and fire of a pit bull. Ellen was counting on that fire. She had a meeting with the county attorney in an hour. She needed Megan's statement and time to fit it into the game plan she was formulating in her head. She wanted her ducks in a row when she sat down across the table from her boss. Rudy Stovich could be unpredictable, but he could also be herded. In her 2 years in Park County, Ellen had honed her shepherding skills to the point that they had become instinctive, reflexive. She didn't know that she even wanted the right case, and still, she was aligning her strategy.
Will you be handling the prosecution?
Megan asked,
working hard to even out her breathing. A fine sheen of sweat glazed her forehead. I'll certainly be a part of it. The county attorney hasn't made his final decision yet.
Well, hell, why rush? It's only been 2 days since we made the collar. Initial appearance is what? All of hours away?
The bond hearing is tomorrow morning.
Will he charge it out or wimp out and go for a grand jury?
That remains to be seen. The media love to make much of grand jury proceedings, as if the word grand somehow implied better or more important. A grand jury hearing was a prosecutor's showcase. They got to present their evidence with no interference from the defense, no cross-examination of their witnesses. There was no need to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt. All they had to show was probable cause that the defendant committed the crime. The grand jury had its uses. In the state of Minnesota, only a grand jury could hand down first-degree murder indictments. But as yet, they weren't dealing with murder, and the thought of handing the fate of this indictment into the hands of 2 dozen citizens made Ellen's palms sweat. The members of a grand jury could do whatever they wanted. They didn't have to listen to the prosecutor's argument. If they didn't want to believe Garrett Wright was capable of evil, he would walk. She could only hope that the ego appeal of doing a solo act in front of a grand jury didn't override Rudy's common sense. Stovich had survived more than a decade as Park County attorney, not so much by his legal wits as by his political wiles. More comfortable with civil law than with criminal law, he handpicked the few felony trials he prosecuted, choosing them for their political value. His courtroom style was dated and clumsy, with all the finesse of a vaudeville player. But Rudy's constituents seldom saw him in a courtroom, and as a glad-handing, ass-kissing backwoods politician, he was without peer.
"Is Wright talking?"
Megan asked quietly. "He isn't saying anything we want to hear. He insists his arrest was a mistake."
"Yeah, right, his mistake. Who's his lawyer?"
"Dennis Enberg, a local attorney."
"Is he just a lawyer? Or is he an asshole lawyer?"
"Denny's okay," Ellen said, flicking off the tape recorder. She'd been in the system too long to take affront. The distinction was one she had made herself from time to time, and, having come from a family of attorneys, she was long since immune to lawyer jokes and slurs. She slid down off the stool and reached for her briefcase. Megan was slipping away from consciousness. Exhaustion and medication were going to end the interview whether she was finished asking questions or not. "He's your basic ham and egger," Ellen continued. "He does the misdemeanor prosecutions for the city of Tatanka. Gets pressed into service as a public defender here from time to time. Has a decent practice of his own. You know how the system works in these rural counties."
"Yeah. Mayberry RFD. So what are you doing here, counselor?"
She shrugged into her heavy wool coat and worked the thick leather buttons into their moorings. "Me? I'm just here to do justice."
"Amen to that."
Ellen had spent her entire 12-year career in the service of one county or another, much to the consternation of her parents, who had wanted her to follow their footsteps into the lucrative life of tax law. Hennepin County, which encompassed the city of Minneapolis and its wealthy western suburbs where she had grown up, had swallowed up the first decade of her life after Mitchell Law in St. Paul. She had immersed herself in the hectic pace, eager to put away as many bad guys as she could. Veterans of the overloaded Hennepin County court system had taken in her enthusiasm with the knowing skepticism of the war-weary and speculated on her burnout date. In 10 years, her tenacity had only toughened, but her enthusiasm had tarnished badly, coated with the verdigris of cynicism. She still remembered clearly the day she had stopped herself in the hall of the Hennepin County courthouse, chilled to the bone by the realization that she had become so inured to all of it that she was beginning to grow numb to the sight of victims and corpses and perpetrators. Not a pleasant epiphany. She hadn't become a prosecutor to foster an immunity to human suffering. She hadn't stayed in the system because she wanted to reach a point where cases were little more than docket numbers and sentencing guidelines. She had become an attorney out of genetic predisposition, environmental conditioning, and a genuine desire to fight for justice. The solution seemed to be to get away from the city, go somewhere more sane, where gangs and major crime were an aberration, a place where she could feel she was making a difference, and not just trying to stick her thumb in a badly leaking dam. Deer Lake had fit the bill perfectly. A town of 15,000. It was near enough to Minneapolis to be convenient, and just far enough away for the town to maintain its rural character. Harris College provided an influx of youth and the sophistication of an academic community. A growing segment of white-collar Twin Cities commuters provided a healthy tax base. Crime, while on the increase, was generally petty. Burglaries, minor drug deals, workers from the Buckland Cheese Factory beating each other senseless after too many beers at the American Legion Hall. People here were still shockable, and they had been shocked to the core by the abduction of Josh Kirkwood. Briefcase clutched in one gloved hand, the low heels of her leather boots clicking against the hard-polished floor, Ellen walked down the corridor of Deer Lake Community Hospital. Most of the activity in the 100-bed facility seemed to center on the combination nurses' station slash reception desk in the main lobby, where people with appointments were complaining about the long wait, and people without appointments tried to appear sicker than they really were in hopes of getting worked in faster. A clutch of reporters, loitering at the periphery of the sick zone, perked up at the sight of Ellen and scooted toward her, pencils and pads at the ready. Two women and four men, an assortment of expensive wool topcoats and scruffy ski jackets, spray-starched coifs and greased-back ponytails. A photographer angled a camera at her, and she turned her head as the flash went off. "Ms. North, do you have any comment on the condition of Agent O'Malley?" "Ms. North, is there any truth to the rumor Garrett Wright sexually assaulted Agent O'Malley?" The second question drew a peeved look from Ellen. "I've heard no such rumor," she said crisply, not even breaking stride. The key to handling the media in full frenzy: keep moving. If you stopped, they would swarm and devour you, and you would be regurgitated as a headline or a soundbite with film at 10. Ellen knew better than to allow herself to be trapped. She had learned those lessons the hard way, having been thrown to the hyenas on occasion as the sacrificial junior assistant on a case. The lack of a juicy answer seemed only to sharpen the reporter's hunger. Two cut around to her left. Two scuttled backward in front of her. The one on her right hopped along sideways, the end of a dirty untied shoelace clacking against the floor with every stride. "What kind of bail will the county attorney request? Can you give us a rundown of the charges being filed?" "The county attorney will be giving a press conference at the courthouse later this afternoon," Ellen said. "I suggest you save your questions until then." She pushed through the hospital's front door, bracing herself automatically for the cold. A pale wash of sunlight filtered weakly down on the pristine snow. On the far side of the parking lot, a tractor rumbled along, plowing the stuff into a minor mountain range. She headed across the lot for her Bonneville, well aware that hers were not the only pair of shoes squeaking over the packed snow. Looking down from the corner of her eye, she saw the loose lace flapping alongside a battered Nike running shoe. "I meant it," she said, fishing her keys out of her coat pocket. "I don't have anything for you." "No comment. Don't feed the bulldog." She cut him a glance. He had to be fresh out of high school, so wet behind the ears he shouldn't have been allowed to go out in the cold without a snowsuit. His face was finely sculpted, black hair, with a suspicious red cast swung down across his narrow brown eyes. He swept it back impatiently. Young Keanu Reeves, God spare me. Not much taller than her own 5'7", he had the build of an alley cat. Lean, agile, with a restless energy to match. It seemed to vibrate in the air around him as if someone had plugged him into a high-voltage generator. "Then I'm afraid your dog will go hungry, Mr. Slater, Adam Slater, Grand Forks Herald." Ellen pulled open the car door and hefted her briefcase across into the passenger seat. "The Grand Forks paper sent their own reporter all the way down here?" "I'm ambitious," he proclaimed, bouncing up and down on the balls of his feet, as if he had to keep himself ready to bolt and run at a second's notice. Cub reporter, trying to race ahead of the ravenous pack. "Are you old enough to have a job?" Ellen asked, cranky with his enthusiasm. You used to be ambitious, too, he said as she climbed behind the wheel of the car. She looked up at him, suspicious that he might know anything at all about her. I have some contacts in Hennepin County. Contacts. He looked as if his contacts would have been the guys who stole the midterm from the algebra teacher's desk. They say you used to be good when you were there. Way back when. I'm still good, Mr. Slater, Ellen declared, twisting the key in the ignition. I'm good in any zip code. Yes, ma'am, he chirped, saluting her with his reporter's notebook. Ma'am, she grumbled as she put the car in gear and headed out of the lot. Her gaze strayed to the rearview mirror as she broke for traffic on the street. Mr. Ambition from Grand Forks was bouncing his way back to the hospital entrance. See if you ever have an affair with an older woman, you little twerp. Used to be good. I haven't lost it yet. She wasn't entirely sure whether she meant her skills in the courtroom or her allure as a woman. As the reporter loped out of view, her gaze refocused on her reflection. Her face was more interesting than beautiful. Oval with a graceful forehead, gray eyes, a little narrow, nose, a little plain, mouth, nothing to inspire erotic fantasies, but it was okay. She scrutinized for any sign of age, not liking the depth of the laugh lines that fanned out beside her eyes when she squinted. How long before she had to stop calling them laugh lines and start calling them crow's feet? A birthday was looming large on the horizon like a big black cloud, like the Hindenburg. 36. A shudder went down her back. She pretended it was from the cold and goosed the Bonneville's heater a notch. 36 was just a number closer to 40 than 30, but just a number, an arbitrary marking of the passing of time. She had more important things to worry about, like a lost boy and bringing his kidnapper to justice. Chapter 2 The Park County Courthouse was a small monument in native limestone with Doric columns and Greek pediments out front. It dated to the late 1800s, when labor was cheap and time of little consequence. The interior boasted soaring ceilings that most likely raised heating bills, and ornate plaster moldings and medallions that undoubtedly required endowments from historical preservationists to maintain. A restoration was underway on the third floor, scaffolding set against the northeast wall like giant tinker toys. The courtrooms on the third floor were the kind of rooms that called to mind Henry Clay and Clarence Darrow. Between the judges' benches, the jury boxes, and the pews for spectators, a sizable forest of oak trees had fallen for the cause. The wooden floors were worn pale in spots from the pacing of generations of lawyers. He was well familiar with courthouses like this one, though he had never been anywhere near Deer Lake, Minnesota. Nor would he ever care to venture back here once his mission was accomplished. Damned cold place. It was a safe bet the Park County Courthouse was seldom as busy as it was today. The halls were bustling, not with staff, but with reporters and cameramen, and newspaper photographers jockeying for position in front of a podium bristling with microphones. He leaned over the second floor railing and looked down through the dark lenses of a pair of mirrored, military-issue sunglasses. The kidnapping of Josh Kirkwood had garnered national attention. The arrest of Dr. Garrett Wright had only turned up the fever pitch another 100 degrees. All the major networks were represented, their correspondents instantly recognizable. The syndicated tabloid news shows were here in force as well, their people skirting the periphery like hyenas, looking to snatch a juicy tidbit from the big network lions. Forced to scramble for camera angles were the local newspeople. They had been thrown into the big pond and clearly didn't care to swim with the big fish, but there it was. The story was bigger than small-town sensibilities and small-town manners. It was as big as America and as intimate as family. Good juxtaposition of images. He committed the line to memory. The scene below was not unlike a movie set waiting for the arrival of the stars. Lights, cameras, grips, technicians, makeup people dabbing the shine off foreheads and noses,
All the world's a stage.
He mumbled with cynical humor, his voice raspy from too many cigars and too little sleep the night before. The price of schmoozing. You oiled the wheels with good whiskey and smooth talk. Easy smiles and expensive cigars. All to be chased the following morning with a handful of aspirin and a gallon of strong coffee. He turned slowly for a casual glance at the reporters waiting outside the door to the county attorney's offices, 30 feet down the hall. No one paid him any mind. He wore no press pass, had not been asked for any ID. He could have been anyone. He could have been a sniper. There were no metal detectors at the doors of the Park County Courthouse. Another detail to file away for future reference. The case was the focus of everyone here, to the exclusion of all else. Elvis could have been sweeping the floors, and no one would have so much as glanced twice. He counted this tunnel vision as being both potentially useful and a blessing to him personally. He could live without the interference as he got himself in where he wanted to be. Inside. The bird's eye view. The catbird seat. Into the inner workings of the small-town justice system, taking on a big-time case. The door to the county attorney's offices opened, and the reporters started shouting questions, sending up a racket like a pack of baying foxhounds. He straightened up from the railing and propped himself up against a marble pillar, careful to remain in its shadow, his hands stuffed into the pockets of the black parka he had bought after getting off the plane in Minneapolis. A uniformed sheriff's deputy cleared a path, leading the way for the man he recognized as Rudy Stovich. Tall, raw-boned, with a face like Mr. Potato Head, and kinky wire-gray hair that was slicked down into a Marcel look with a cord of something greasy. Stovich had been featured in one of many news clippings about the case, scowling at the camera, piously promising to prosecute the villains to the fullest extent of the law. It would be interesting to hear what he had to say now that it appeared the villain was not some slimy ex-con from the wrong side of town and the lower end of the evolutionary ladder, but a psychology professor from their own exclusive college. Garrett Wright was the twist that made the story unique, the hook that made it bankable instead of cliched. Stovich stepped into the hall, waving off the shouted questions, mugging an expression of exaggerated impatience. A woman fell into step beside him. Cool, composed, blonde hair the shade of polished gold, features that were more interesting than striking. Ellen North, rumored to have her ambitious eye on the county attorney's corner office. She walked past the reporters, without making eye contact, a queen oblivious to the presence of the unwashed masses. Classy. Self-possessed, not rattled by the attention of the press. Intriguing. He stayed where he was as the mob passed by and headed down the steps for the first floor. Showtime. No director could have choreographed the scene more perfectly. Just as Stovich and his entourage reached the first floor, the main doors of the courthouse swung open and State Attorney General William Glendenning and his cadre made their grand entrance. They came into the building on a gust of cold air, stamping the snow from their shoes, their cheeks, and noses polished cherry red with cold. Stovich and Glendenning shook hands as flashes went off in blinding starbursts. Glendenning opened the proceedings. A seasoned politician, he looked good before the lights. Solid, conservative, trustworthy. A pair of rimless spectacles gave him a certain resemblance to Franklin Roosevelt. More emphasis on trust and old-fashioned values. He spoke with a strong, confident voice. Platitudes and promises of justice, assurances of his trust in the system, and his trust in Rudy Stovich and his staff. He sounded impressive, while he actually said very little. A handy trick in an election year. Stovich followed, stony-faced and serious, his old photo-gray glasses cockeyed, his suit looking like something he had pulled out of a laundry basket. His necktie was too short. He told everyone he was deeply troubled by the events that had rocked his community. He was just a country lawyer who had never imagined he would have to deal with a case of this nature, which was why he was passing the buck to Assistant County Attorney Ellen North. She had the kind of courtroom experience it would take. She was young and sharp
and relentless in her pursuit of justice.
"Slick move, Rudy," he mumbled, leaning once again on the railing. "Slick as snot, you old country fox."
Dumping the case on her was calculated damage control. He painted himself as a man concerned for justice above all else, willing to admit there was someone better suited to achieve that end, and a woman, no less, scoring a point for him with a growing faction of enlightened young professionals in his constituency. At the same time, he distanced himself from the prosecution, deflected the blows of public criticism, and kept his bulbous nose clean. If Ellen North won, Rudy would look like a wise and humble genius. If she lost, it would be entirely her fault. Whether Stovich had a genuine respect for his assistant, or was in fact throwing her to the wolves, was another twist with possibilities. One thing was perfectly clear as Ellen North stepped up to the podium. She wasn't afraid of the job or the press. Her statement was brief and to the point. She intended to prosecute this case aggressively and win justice for the victims. She would do all that was in her power to try to find the answer to the ultimate question in this situation, the whereabouts of Josh Kirkwood. She refused to take questions from the press, deftly maneuvering her boss back into the spotlight. Ever grateful for a press opportunity in an election year, Stovich grabbed the chance, pulling Glendenning into the limelight with him. Photos with a head honcho of the state's justice system always made for nice campaign posters. Ellen North snagged a deputy for protection and made her break for the stairs. He watched as several reporters broke away from the pack to pursue her. She stopped them with a look and a sharp, "No comment," never slowing her step.
"Ms. North,"
he growled under his breath as she mounted the steps, the hem of her deep green skirt swirling around her calves.
"I do believe I am in lust."
She came down the hall, the low heels of her boots smacking sharply against the polished floor. All business and no distractions, her mind occupied by things other than the notion that someone might be watching her from the shadows. He didn't look like the kind of man who could steal a child and plunge a community into a vortex of fear. Ellen had met Garrett Wright at a number of civic functions over the past 2 years. He had seemed pleasant enough, not the type to draw attention to himself. He would have melted into a crowd if not for the almost pretty quality of his face. A fine alabaster oval with a slim nose and a prim mouth. He took his seat with as much dignity as he could, considering the rattling of the hardware the police had used to accessorize the blaze orange city jail jumpsuit.
"Ms. North,"
he said with a spare smile,
"I would say it's a pleasure to see you again, but considering the circumstances..."
He shrugged, lifting his shackled hands by way of further explanation, then settled them gently on the tabletop. Smooth, pale hands with no scrapes, no contusions, no obvious signs of having struck a woman repeatedly. Ellen wondered if he had put his hands before her knowing she would look. She raised her gaze to his. His eyes were a deep, fathomless brown, large, almost drowsy-looking behind lashes most women would have killed for. "This isn't a social call, Dr. Wright," she said crisply. "Pleasure doesn't enter into it." "Ms. North will be handling the prosecution," Dennis Enberg explained. He turned to Ellen. "I hear Rudy put on a good show at the press conference." "I'm surprised you weren't there." The attorney shrugged it off. "Not my style. It was Rudy's circus, no place for a pissing contest." In her 2-year acquaintance with Dennis Enberg, she would have said it was exactly his style to crash the county attorney's party if he thought it would do him good. She had certainly never known him to demur for the sake of manners. It struck Ellen as a tactical error. Had she been Wright's attorney, she would certainly have done her best to steal Rudy's thunder, if only to make the obvious perfunctory statement of her client's innocence. "Denny, you know Cameron Reed," she said, nodding to the young man sitting to her left at the fake wood-grain table. The men half rose from their chairs to shake hands. Enberg, 37 and pudgy, with brown hair and serious retreat from his forehead, and Cameron Reed, 28 and fit beyond reason, his hair a shock of rich copper that came with a full accompaniment of freckles. 2 years out of Mitchell Law, he was sharp and eager, a true anomaly in the Park County office. How he had ended up in Park County was beyond Ellen, though that thought always brought her up short. No one would have expected her to be here either. "Dr. Wright, your bond hearing is set for 10 o'clock tomorrow morning," she began. "I want you to be aware of the fact that the state intends to serve you at that time with a complaint charging you with a long list of felonies regarding the kidnapping of Josh Kirkwood and the kidnapping and assault of BCA agent Megan O'Malley." She glanced up at Wright over the rims of a pair of reading glasses that were more prop than prescription. He seemed almost impassive, returning her gaze with his steady dark eyes. No one spoke, and for a few seconds Ellen had the strange sensation that Cameron and Enberg had somehow been frozen out of the moment.
"Is that supposed to induce me to confess to crimes I didn't commit?"
he asked quietly. "It's a statement of fact, Dr. Wright. I want you to be fully aware of my intent to prosecute." Enberg's brows drew together. "I heard rumors of a grand jury." "I don't need a grand jury. Of course, if Josh Kirkwood isn't returned, I may well convene a grand jury to consider murder charges based on the evidence we have."
"Murder?"
The exclamation propelled Enberg half a foot off the seat of his chair.
"Jesus, Ellen, isn't that a little premature?"
"Even as we speak, the state crime lab is conducting tests on the bloody sheet your client wrapped around Agent O'Malley. Evidence. He said so himself."
"So says a woman who was, by her own admission, drugged and beaten senseless."
"The lab has confirmed that, in addition to Agent O'Malley's blood, there is blood on the sheet type AB negative. Josh Kirkwood's blood type."
"And a billion other people's."
"Clear evidence of grievous bodily harm," she continued. "From this evidence, we might deduce that the reason the police aren't finding Josh is that Josh is dead."
"Oh, for—"
Enberg sputtered, at a loss for a suitable diatribe. The red in his face pushed out to the rims of his ears. Seemingly unable to contain his temper to the confines of a chair, he rose and began to pace along the end of the table. Ellen had seen this act before, and, frankly, he had been more convincing. It seemed forced this time, as if he was having trouble working up outrage. He paced along the end of the table, behind an empty chair, rather than behind Garrett Wright, which would have been symbolic of his support for his client.
"I didn't kill Josh Kirkwood," Garrett Wright said softly.
Ellen found herself holding her breath, waiting, expectation building inside her. The weight of his silence hinted at an announcement.
God, was he going to confess after all?
For a heartbeat, she had the insane thought he was going to smile. Then, in a blink, the expression was gone, and she thought she must have imagined it.
"I'm an innocent man, Ms. North," he said. "I keep telling you that. What would possibly motivate me to kidnap a neighbor's child? I admire Hannah Garrison tremendously. My wife and I consider Hannah and Paul friends. And as for kidnapping Megan O'Malley, that seems more like the work of a madman. Do I strike you as being insane?"
"That's not for me to determine."
"I don't believe this," he muttered. "I'm a professor at one of the most highly respected small colleges in the country. For anyone to believe I could have done any of these things, it doesn't make sense."
"It makes his kind of sense." In her mind's eye, Ellen could see Megan's face, bruised and battered, the fire of hatred burning in her eyes.
"It was him, the son of a bitch. We got him dead to fucking rights."
"My job is applying the law to what you did, Dr. Wright, not making sense of it. I leave that unenviable and unproductive task to sociologists."
"I did nothing."
"How strange, then, that Chief Holt apprehended you fleeing the scene." Wright tipped his head back and blew a sigh at the acoustic tile in the ceiling.
"I keep telling you, it was a mistake. I had just got home. I parked my car in the garage and started for the house. I heard what I thought might be gunshots and stepped out the back door to see. I saw a man running toward me from the neighbor's yard.
Understandably frightened, I stepped back into the garage with the intent of going into the house to call the police. Then the door flew open, and Mitch Holt tackled me.
Cameron leaned forward, his forearms braced on the table, his blue eyes bright.
"You thought you heard gunshots in your backyard, so you stepped outside? That seems odd, Dr. Wright. I think that would be the last thing I'd do. Weren't you afraid of being shot?"
"People don't get shot in Deer Lake," Wright scoffed. "I thought it was probably some kids fooling around in Quarry Hills Park, shooting at rabbits or something."
"At night? During a blizzard?"
The muscles around his mouth tightened ever so slightly as he regarded Cameron Reed. "The man Mitch Holt chased through the woods was dressed in black," Ellen said. "When apprehended, you were dressed in black, breathing hard, perspiring even."
"If Mitch Holt burst into your garage and tackled you, you'd be breathing hard and sweating too," Dennis said, jumping back into the fray with half-hearted sarcasm.
He dropped back down into his chair and crossed his arms.
"Mitch Holt never saw the face of the man he was chasing. Agent O'Malley never saw the face of the man who tortured her. I'm told the suspect was wearing a ski mask. My client was not wearing a ski mask when he was tackled."
"But a ski mask was found in the woods along the trail," Ellen reminded him.
"What about the gun?" Enberg challenged. "The paraffin test taken Saturday night revealed no traces of gunpowder on my client's hands."
"People generally wear gloves in the winter," Cameron offered, with his own twist of sarcasm. Denny shrugged dramatically.
"So, where are they?"
"Disposed of during the chase, like the hat," Ellen said. "They'll be found."
"Until they are, and until you can prove they were on my client's hands, they don't exist."
"You can pretend they don't exist, Dennis," she said, "the same way you can pretend your client is innocent. Your denial won't change the fact that he's as guilty as sin, and barring new developments, will be going away for the rest of his life with no hope of ever setting foot outside the walls of a prison."
She turned her attention back to Garrett Wright as she gathered her notes.
"As for your story, Doctor, I've seen sieves with fewer holes. I suggest you do some hard thinking tonight. Though I won't make promises, I think it's safe to say the county attorney's office would view this situation in a kinder light if you were to tell the truth."
"Is it really the truth you want, Ms. North?" he asked quietly. "Or is it another conviction for your record? It's no secret you're a very ambitious lady."
"It's always news to me."
Ellen snapped her briefcase shut and rose, giving him a look as cold as steel.
"What I want, Dr. Wright, is justice. And make no mistake, I'll get it."
Denny Enberg watched the pair of prosecutors leave, a sick heaviness resting like a stone in the pit of his stomach. Whether it was the prospect of losing the forthcoming battle, or the idea of fighting this fight at all that made him nauseous, he didn't know. He wasn't sure he wanted to know. He could feel the weight of his client's gaze on him and felt compelled to dredge up some scrap of wit.
"You always know where Ellen stands on a case," he said, busying himself scooping his notes together. "Just to the right of your jugular."
"Do you think I'm guilty, Dennis?" Wright asked.
Color touched Enberg's cheekbones.
"I'm your attorney, Garrett. I told you up front, the only thing I ask is that you don't lie to me. You agreed. If you tell me you're innocent, you're innocent. I'll do everything I can to make the court believe it, too."
The jailer came in then, granite-faced, and led Garrett Wright through the door to the cell block. Denny watched him go, listened to the rattle of the leg irons, that weight in his gut growing heavier and heavier. He always stated his big rule to his clients with a bluff sense of worldly wisdom, as if to tell them they might as well not even try to keep the truth from him because he could smell a lie like stink on shit. Most of them fell for it. Most of them were doofus losers who wouldn't have needed his help if they'd had two brain cells to rub together. But the big rule had a big catch-22, and he knew it. If Garrett Wright was guilty, then he was guilty of horrible things, and lying would surely be the least of them.
"That's a pretty lame story," Cameron said, as he and Ellen walked toward the security door at the end of the hall. You might think a professor could come up with something more compelling. Maybe that's his angle. It's so weak, we're supposed to believe it couldn't be anything but the truth. The door swung open. Nodding to the officer, they took a right and started down the stairs. Cameron glanced at his watch and grimaced. "Oh, man, I'm late. I've got to run," he said. "I told Fred Nelson I'd meet with him at 4:30. He wants to talk dispo on that trucker from Canada. Will you need me later?" "I don't think so. Phoebe is typing up the complaint, even as we speak." Ellen watched him bolt down the stairs two at a time, with the grace of Baryshnikov. She followed, all but dragging her feet, the weight of the day bearing down on her. Rudy had handed the case to her, or dumped it on her. She still wasn't sure which. Still wasn't sure who had manipulated whom in that meeting. The self-preservationist in her told her she didn't want him within 5 miles of this case. It had the smell of bad meat, looked to be rife with booby traps, and the media would scrutinize her every move. Harris college students with picket signs had already begun protesting Wright's arrest on the sidewalk in front of the courthouse. But her sense of justice told her that if Josh Kirkwood and his parents and Megan O'Malley were to get any justice at all, she would have to be the one to prosecute the case. That was a fact that had nothing to do with ego. She was, flat out, the best of the 5 prosecutors in the Park County Attorney's office. And so, she would clean up the tag-end stuff she had on her schedule, shift newer cases to Quentin Adler, and hope he could bungle his way through them without completely screwing up. And she would concentrate on putting Dr. Garrett Wright in prison. No reporters were waiting to ambush her in the lobby of the Law Enforcement Center. Mitch Holt had banished them from his wing of Deer Lake City Center. The lovely new brick building housed the city jail and police department in one half of its 2-story V-shape, and the city government offices in the other. The atrium at the apex of the V would be lousy with reporters. That was the scene of their last great spectacle related to the case. A live interview with an outraged Paul Kirkwood. Josh's father had been livid at Mitch's request that he come in to be fingerprinted, even though the request had been more than reasonable. It would have been within Mitch's power to haul Kirkwood in as a suspect at that point. Paul had failed to inform the police that he had once owned the van belonging to suspect and convicted pedophile Ole Swain, had in fact denied knowledge of any such van after a witness had come forward to say she may have seen Josh getting into a vehicle of that description on the night of his disappearance. That still bothered Ellen, like a sliver she couldn't quite get at just beneath her skin. Why lie about the van? Why deny he had sold it to Ole Swain when the proof was right there in the DMV records? Unfortunately, Ole wasn't around to help solve the mystery. Facing certain prison time on parole violations, to say nothing of the possible charges regarding Josh's disappearance, Swain had committed suicide while in custody. The BCA had gone over his van with every tool they had and had found nothing. Not a hair, not a thread from a mitten, not a thing belonging to Josh. Ole had sworn his innocence to the very end, scrawling it on the wall of his cell in blood. Cutting through the squad room of the police department, where desks were piled with paperwork and phones rang without cease, Ellen headed for Holt's office. The door to his outer office stood open, but Ellen still paused in the hall and wrapped her knuckles on the doorframe before sticking her head in. Mitch's administrative assistant, Natalie Bryant, swung around from her filing cabinets with a scowl on her round mahogany face and thunder in the dark eyes behind her red-framed glasses, ready to take a bite out of the interloper. The look relaxed upon recognition to show the same kind of weariness Ellen was feeling. "Girl, tell me you're going to crack that man like the cockroach he is. I'd pay money to see it," she said, propping a fist on one well-rounded hip. "I'll do my best," Ellen promised. "I'd like to do my best all over his head." "Is Mitch in?" "He figured you'd drop by. Go on in." "Thanks." Deer Lake's police chief sat behind his desk, looking the way Ellen imagined Harrison Ford would look after a week-long bender. Brown eyes bloodshot and underlined with dark circles, lean cheeks shadowed with stubble. He had jerked loose the knot in his tie and combed his hair with his fingers, leaving tufts standing up here and there. Well, it's official, she said. I have been duly appointed to slay the dragon.
Good.
His response held more confidence than she could muster at the moment. Ellen glanced around the office. There was no ego wall laden with plaques and commendations he had garnered in his years as a cop, though she knew there were many. He had been a top detective with the Miami Force for a dozen years, coming to Deer Lake after the death of his wife and young son in a convenience store holdup. He had chosen Deer Lake as a sanctuary in a truer sense than she had. I've had my little tête-à-tête with Wright and his lawyer, basically told him to confess or else, for all the good that will do. Oh, for the days of rubber truncheons. Yeah, she drawled. Human rights can be such a drag. He doesn't qualify as human in my book. He brightened with sarcastic false hope. Hey, a loophole! That might be all the defense I'd need. I'm going to try to talk to Wright's wife tonight, Ellen said. She's still at the Fontaine? Yeah, the BCA guys were still going over the house today. We've got Karen under 24-hour surveillance, in case she was involved. I don't think she had a clue what her husband was doing. She's not the brightest bulb in the chandelier to begin with. Now she's so distraught, she can barely function. I didn't get anywhere with her, but you might have better luck woman to woman. Let's hope. She could hear the phone ringing in the outer office, but no calls were being put through to Mitch. Natalie was running interference for him. The last 2 weeks had been hell on him. As Deer Lake's chief and the only detective on the 30-man force, he had shouldered the burden of the search for Josh and an investigation that ran virtually around the clock. His professional and personal lives had been under constant scrutiny by the press. I spoke with Megan this afternoon, she said, as he rose and came around the end of the desk to see her to the door. She's got a rough road ahead of her.
Yeah.
He tried to put on a game expression, but it hung a little crooked, letting the worry peek through.
But she's a tough cookie. She'll gut it out.
And you'll be there to help her.
If I have anything to say about it.
She's lucky to have you. You're a good guy, Mitch.
Yeah, that's me. Last of the good guys.
Don't say that. I'd like to think there's a couple left out there for us single women. It's that hope that keeps us shaving our legs, you know. The press had either lost her or given up on her for the afternoon. Deadlines beckoned them if Ellen North did not. He had no deadlines except the statute of limitations on his anonymity. He stood just outside a back door to Deer Lake City Center, freezing his ass and cursing Minnesota's stringent anti-smoking laws. In the time it took to smoke a cigarette, he had already lost the feeling in his smaller toes. She came out of the building through a side door, muttering to herself, head bent as she pulled her keys out of her handbag. He tossed his cigarette butt at a snowbank.
Ms. North, may I have a word?
Ellen jerked her head up at the sound of the voice, a honey-and-smoke drawl from the deep south. Damned reporters, lurking everywhere but under the bushes. And they would have been there, too, if the bushes hadn't been buried under 3 feet of snow. This one came toward her with a long, purposeful stride, the collar of his black coat turned up high, hands jammed into his pockets.
No, that's your word, she snapped. I said all I have to say at the press conference. If you didn't get your soundbite then, that's too bad.
She kept walking, frowning as he stayed just in front of her, walking backward.
You're lucky I believe in handgun control, she said. Don't you know any better than to sneak up on a woman in a dark parking lot?
He grinned at her, a wicked pirate's grin that flashed white in an angular face, shadowed by a day's growth of beard.
Don't you know any better than to assume a stranger coming at you in a dark parking lot is a reporter?
The question cut through Ellen like a knife. What sun there had been earlier in the day was gone, swept away by a bank of clouds and the onset of evening. Though there was a police force inside the building she had just left, there wasn't another soul in the parking lot. She thought of Josh Kirkwood, his parents, everyone in Deer Lake who had made the assumption they were safe here. Even after everything that had happened in the last 2 weeks, she still felt personally immune. How stupid. How naive. An image of Megan flashed through her mind. Megan, her face a palette of bruises and stitches. Megan hadn't seen her attacker. "We fooled you all along," he said. "We. Always we." Even in the faint wash of light from the street lamps, he had to see the color drain from her face. Her gaze darted toward her car, then back to the building, judging distances as her step slowed to a standstill.
"I'm no rapist,"
he assured her, with a certain amount of amusement. "I'd be a fool to take your word for that, wouldn't I?"
"Yes, ma'am,"
he conceded with a tip of his head.
"Ma'am,"
Ellen snarled under her breath, trying to muster up some anger to counteract the sudden burst of fear. She took a slow step back toward the building. "Now I do wish I had a gun."
"If I were after you for nefarious purposes," he said as he advanced on her, "would I be so careless as to approach you here?"
He pulled a gloved hand from his pocket and gestured gracefully to the parking lot, like a magician drawing attention to his stage.
"If I wanted to harm you," he said, stepping closer, "I would be smart enough to follow you home. Find a way to slip into your house or garage, catch you where there would be little chance of witnesses or interference."
He let those images take firm root in her mind.
"That's what I would do, if I were the sort of rascal who preys on women."
He smiled again.
"Which I am not."
"Who are you and what do you want?" Ellen demanded, unnerved by the fact that a part of her brain catalogued his manner as charming. No, not charming. Seductive. Disturbing.
"J. Butler Brooks. I'm a writer. True crime. I can show you my driver's license if you'd like,"
he offered, but made no move to reach for it, only took another step toward her, never letting her get enough distance between them to diffuse the electric quality of the tension.
"I'd like for you to back off," Ellen said.
She started to hold up a hand, a gesture meant to stop him in his tracks, or a foolish invitation for him to grab hold of her arm. Pulling the gesture back, she hefted her briefcase in her right hand, weighing its potential as a weapon or a shield. "If you think I'm getting close enough to you to look at a DMV photo, you must be out of your mind."
"Well, I have been so accused once or twice, but it never did stick. Now my Uncle Hooter, he's a different story. I could tell you some tales about him. Over dinner, perhaps?"
"Perhaps not." He gave her a crestfallen look that was ruined by the sense that he was more amused than affronted.
"After I waited for you out here in the cold?"
"After you stalked me and skulked around in the shadows?" She corrected him, moving another step backward. "After you've done your best to frighten me?"
"I frighten you, Miss North? You don't strike me as the sort of woman who would be easily frightened. That's certainly not the impression you gave at the press conference."
"I thought you said you aren't a reporter."
"No one at the courthouse ever asked," he confessed. "They assumed the same way you assumed. Forgive my pointing it out at this particular moment, but assumptions can be very dangerous things. Your boss needs to have a word with someone about security. This is a highly volatile case you've got here. Anything might happen. The possibilities are virtually endless. I'd be happy to discuss them with you." "Over drinks," he suggested. "You look like you could do with one."
"If you want to see me, call my office."
"Oh, I want to see you, Ms. North,"
he murmured, his voice an almost tangible caress.
"I'm not big on appointments, though. Preparation time eliminates spontaneity."
"That's the whole point."
"I prefer to catch people off balance," he admitted. "They reveal more of their true selves."
"I have no intention of revealing anything to you." She stopped her retreat as a group of people emerged from the main doors of City Center. "I should have you arrested." He arched a brow.
"On what charge, Ms. North? Attempting to hold a conversation? Surely y'all are not so inhospitable as your weather here in Minnesota, are you?"
She gave him no answer. The The voices of the people who had come out of the building rose and fell, only the odd word breaking clear as they made their way down the sidewalk. She turned and fell into step with the others as they passed. Jay watched her walk away, head up, chin out, once again projecting an image of cool control. She didn't like being caught off guard. He would have bet money she was a list maker, a rule follower, the kind of woman who dotted all her I's and crossed all her T's, then double-checked them for good measure. She liked boundaries. She liked control. She had no intention of revealing anything to him. But you already